Hi, this is Danielle from The Jealous Curator, and this is episode 94 of Art for Your Ear. This episode is supported by Saatchi Art, the world's largest curated online gallery offering original art by independent artists from around the world. Visit their online gallery at saatchiart.com. Now, today is all about ceramics, functional pieces that can be found on shelves in lovely stores around the world, and breathtaking installation art that hangs in galleries and museums all around the world. And yep, you guessed it. All of it is created by the same artist. Molly Hatch is my guest today, and I cannot wait to ask her a few, or a lot, of behind-the-scenes questions. I know how successful she is now, collaborating with big brands, selling fine art installations, but how did she do that, and when did it happen? Time to find out. Calling Molly in Northampton, Massachusetts.
Hi, Molly.
Nice to meet you over the waves of the internet.
I know, and I'm looking at a really cute picture of you, and you're probably looking at a picture of my husband.
Exactly.
I don't actually have stubble. I usually take care of that, but...
Oh, yeah. Good idea.
Yeah. I'm so happy that you were able to do this.
Oh, of course. I've definitely listened to the podcast, and I love watching your feed on social media, and even check out the blog from time to time, so...
Oh, nice.
It's an honor for me.
Well, I was going to write a big post about you, and then I was like, why don't I just have her on the podcast and write an even bigger post?
Wow. Well, I'm honored, really.
Oh, well, no. I have just been staring at your Instagram feed for the last, like, hour. Oh, my gosh. Even, you know, there's that one of just your little color tests?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. My God. That even, I was like, I'd just hang that on my wall.
And did you get to see the Molly Hatch studio Instagram feed?
No.
So I have a separate Instagram feed for my one-of-a-kind artwork.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I haven't even been over there. Okay, well, so this is just going to lead into all of the questions, because I don't know when you sleep. There's so much stuff.
I try to sleep 8 hours a day.
Do you really?
I do. Wow. I have moments where I don't do it as much as I would like to, but yeah, somehow I manage.
That is impressive. Okay, well, you know how this rolls then. I know one thing about your childhood that I saw on your site. A dairy farmer and an artist. Is that right? Your parents?
Right. So my mom is a painter, and not for a living, but always been a studio practice, you know, lifelong studio practice. And she actually went to RISD for painting and dropped out to marry my father, who was an aspiring dairy farmer who, you know, they married. She was 19 and he was like 25 or something when they married, and they ran off to Wisconsin from the East Coast and started a dairy farm. And I came only a couple of years later, and it's definitely been formative, you know, being, I think my work ethic probably instilled pretty early
on.
Wow.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And so have you ever talked to your mom about that? Like, does she ever wish she'd finish art school, or is she fine with like just doing her own thing?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting thread, because my grandmother was a painter and my great grandmother is a painter as well. And it was all sort of hobby, and my grandmother earned a little bit of money, through painting portraits of homes in watercolor, but I'm really the first person in the family to make a living off of it. But it's definitely something that's been part of
the DNA.
Paradigm. Yeah, the sort of family paradigm, I guess.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, there's part of our family story, and the Metcalf family side of my family, which is my mother's side of the family, had something to do with the founding of RISD. And so there's a long history of art and art appreciation and collecting in the family, although the finances that went with that once upon a time are no longer there. But a lot of the sort of class expectations, like my mother was definitely the sort of first generation to have to like really go and earn a living. So it was sort of an interesting thing to kind of come to grips with. And it was sort of funny stories around how I found out about all of that, because it's sort of like you don't really talk about that, and then you do talk about it when someone asks the right questions. It's like a funny part of my history, but my mother and I've had a lot of conversations over the years about it, and she's tried a few times to make a living off of her work, and never with quite enough time to put into it. Like, she'll do 3 years, and then it won't really take off, and then the sort of, I think the commercial aspect of it is really hard for her, and she hasn't found the right marketplace for the work, and I really think, strongly feel that there is a market for her work. It's just the work of finding the right market is the part that she, and in a lot of ways, I've really had to redefine my understanding of success over my career, from being a student in art school to going to graduate school and for ceramics, and understanding what I thought my career was going to be after that, to sort of surpassing a lot of goals that I had set for myself artistically, and then a whole career that I didn't, as a designer, that I didn't even set out.
Yeah, no kidding.
But watching my mother, you know, honestly, I feel like her studio practice is almost more successful than most people's, because she's doing it regardless of the commercial success.
Yeah.
And I find that, like, I find myself setting the goal to just still be making in some capacity for the rest of my life. Whether or not I'm doing it to earn a living doesn't really matter to me. And it's been interesting to kind of come around to that as a definition of success. When early on it was more about, you know, the sort of the stereotypical vision of what an artist is supposed to be. I mean, I went to a very traditional fine arts school. I went to the museum school in Boston for my undergraduate degree, and they're part of Tufts University. So my degree is actually from Tufts, but my studies were done in the studio arts at the museum school. And they really train people to be studio artists. Like, the idea was that you were going to go out and, like, be a painter and make a living off your paintings, which is sort of amazing to think of, like, a whole school of people kind of out to do that, because it's so impossible.
Oh, my gosh.
Yet here I am, and I'm doing this thing, and it's, like, I pinch myself often.
Yeah, well, you obviously work really hard. Okay, well, I need to go back a little bit. Yeah, so,
sure.
Okay, so you're a little kid. Are you an only child?
No, I have a younger brother who's a CTO of a, well, not technically a CTO. He was the IT guy as part of a startup in New York. So he's a computer technology guy. And I kind of strongly remember, we had a very interesting childhood, which we could spend the entire podcast on my, like, commune upbringing with Quaker values and, like, like the hippie, like, back to the land, DIY, like, it's all been very formative, but we could literally spend, like, the entire time talking about that. But there was a point in our childhood where he was like, this not having money thing is really not for me. Like, I need to go. I was like, you go do that. I think I'm going to be an artist. And my father's like, you know you're not going to make any money. So.
Surprise.
I was like, what the fuck? Yeah, that's be a theme. Like, you tell me not to do it, and then I go do it.
Yeah. Well, and so when you were little, were you, it sounds like you were probably just making stuff constantly then.
Yeah, you know, I think my response to not having the money to buy the things that I wanted, which I think a lot of people have the perception of, you know, you always sort of, your parents put limitations on you. It was like, if you want it, you have to make it.
Yeah.
So I would make things. And my mother was incredibly industrious and supportive of that. And we had lots of, like, I don't know if you remember, like, 70s craft books that were like, you could make this thing out of paper mache. And it was
Oh, yes. I had many of those.
They were strange projects, but I did them, like, all of them.
Did you ever make Stumpkins?
I don't know what those are.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, I actually found the book online a while ago because I was like, I wonder if this is still out there. It was from the 70s, like, late 70s, early 80s. And they're, like, these little people that you make out of old nylons.
My gosh.
I have made hundreds of them. I made them for Easter and Christmas and gifts for people, and my dad still has it. Like, they're horrible. When my husband first saw them, he was just like, that's terrifying. But I love them. I will find the book for you, and I will send you an email, because it's hilarious.
That would be kind of amazing, and I would have been totally out of luck as a child, because my mother, like, owned one bra And nylon were definitely not part of the, like,
the
I could
Quaker
not
lifestyle.
My mother's trend. Like, it wasn't going to be very unsuccessful, very unfruitful.
Oh, no. Well, you would have been very jealous of me then because I was a rolling in it.
Yeah.
We also used to make pickled bums. We made little bums out of nylons, and then we put them in jars and make them look like, you know, like little jars of pickles, and you'd even put pickling spice in, but it would just be these little nylon bums, and it would be pickled bums.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, you had a very different childhood. Like, I don't, because we actually made pickles. We just made pickles.
Yeah, so did we. But there were also pickled bums, you know, nearby. That's why I had the mason jars and I had all the stuff. But then there was this like weird night. It was very Cabbage Patch Kitty. Do you know what I mean? That kind of bum. Anyway, I don't even know how I'm talking about this. So you're making stuff. And so I guess that having a mom that was an artist, did you assume that you would go off to art school?
No, you know, I actually only applied to the museum school. It was the only art school that I applied to, and I really thought I was going to go be a historian or some kind of English major. And I honestly think I probably would have ended up being an art historian or a curator if I hadn't ended up, like, one of my favorite. Like, my favorite group of people that I always feel at home with, aside from ceramic artists. Like, if you ever hang out in a room of ceramic artists, it's like they're all nice and they're all like,
that's
they
what
all
I've like always heard.
Good food. You know, it's like, it's a really great group of people. There's a lot of Carhartts going around, but it's a great group of people. And I, like, you know, you're in the right job when you, like, could be friends with anybody in your field instantly. But curators, whenever I'm in an art fair context or I'm working with a museum on a commission or something, like, we have, like, synergy. Like, there's, like, a thing happening there. So that's my theory, is that I would have ended up being a curator if not an artist. But I really wanted to go to Reed College in Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And I applied. I got in, and I got into a bunch of the schools that I applied to. I was really lucky. And the only school that offered me financial aid was the museum school. They offered me like a 50% ride, and it was a really expensive private school. And I was kind of like, this might be the universe telling me something.
Wow.
I should probably listen to that. So I went. And Tufts, I mean, having a degree from Tufts University is amazing. I felt like I got like a backdoor entry to
wow.
this amazing school.
Well, and so did you go for painting? Is that what you went in to do?
I actually went in thinking I was going to be a photographer, and just give you a little window in my mindset when I really thought I was amazing. I went in, and this is pre-computer registration, pre-email. Like, we no one even had email. And this is about way back in the 90s.
You and I are probably the same age, because I remember registering by phone. Did you have to do the dial in with the numbers and stuff?
Oh, no, we didn't even. This is like the museum school was like super intense. You lined up by class. And you had to go to the professor with your portfolio and, like, present your artwork to the professor and be like, I really want to get in your class. And they would be like, yes, or they'd be like, no.
In that moment?
Yes. It was really intense. It was like having a portfolio review to get into a class.
My God. How old? So were you, like, 18?
Mm-hmm.
That's terrifying.
Yep, it was pretty intense. So you go in, and I went into the photography teacher. And he was this big hotshot photographer, and I thought I had already done a bunch of photography in high school, and he was like, you need to go back to photography one. And I was like, I'm never taking another photo class again. and I didn't, actually, and I think it was mostly just because I actually was interested in other things, but the museum school is odd. They don't have any requirements for a major. You don't declare a major. You don't ever have to show up to class. There's no attendance. There's no grades. So for me at that time, it was like, you could just take whatever classes you want. There weren't prerequisites. There weren't, it was really bizarre. Like, wow. You created your own curriculum. But I started taking a painting class with an artist named Kurt Kauper, who's really well known for his figurative painting. And I started making these paintings, and I was like making my mom's paintings. And I just was like, this is so weird. Like, I didn't have my own voice yet. And so I think I just was like, you know what, at the core of everything that I'm going to do, at the core of everything in art practices in general, is drawing. And so I just started taking a ton of drawing classes, and I found a home in those classes. I really just exhausted the curriculum there. And then in my last year of school, I found ceramics, and I'd been taking it like a pottery. I'd taken a pottery class my first summer of school and sort of dawdled in it, and it was like fun, and I loved throwing, and it was like this nice thing, but I didn't feel quite like, I was like, all right, so I don't know what to do with that, but it sort of hung out there in the periphery. And this amazing force of a woman, it was like on an all-male run department in ceramics, but this woman came in for a year as a visiting artist named Kathy King, and she had these like Betty Page bangs and tattoos and like biker boots, and I was like, now there is a professor, you know, like I was like, who is this? And she just took one look at what I was doing and was like, you're making these pots and you're making these drawings, you need to do the drawings on the pots. And it was like, that was it for me. It was all over.
Wow.
Sort of deconstructing this or pretension of art for me was huge. Like to take something that drawing is like one of my major issues with how like sort of the academy is that we've built up this sort of you're supposed to know thing and you're supposed to understand the artwork and there's so much theory and all that that goes behind it. And believe me, I put my time into understanding that, but what happens when you remove that from that context and you take the frame away and you put it on something that someone's going to like lick and drink out of, and it suddenly brings it out and someone can at least relate to it on the most basic, like banal functional level. And it was like, you know, like I can subversively put my drawings out there. And so like my entire career really is grounded in the sort of traditional modes of drawing and painting, combining that with an interest in sort of breaking down those, like how do you make a plate into a painting or an object into a painting and a painting into an object? And at the very least sort of hopefully reach an audience that will sort of have a window or an approachability to the work through understanding what a plate is.
Yeah.
Very basic level. They can get that it's a plate that's acting in a different way. And so there's an entry point there that it's been really successful and it's really nice to be able to. And I think that's a little bit of me like talking to my dad, who's like, you're not going to make, what the hell is this art thing anyway? You know, and he's kind of like, oh, like I get it. He kind of gets it. And it's like, it's really satisfying when you have people of all ages and a huge range, like get it.
Yeah. You know, it is so funny because I didn't send you any questions ahead of time.
Right.
Sometimes I do that with people if they kind of want the gist of what we're going to talk about. You said, surprise me. Question number two, what came first, ceramics or illustration? Or were you illustrating on ceramics from the get-go?
Yeah, so.
So
I mean,
there you go.
Yeah, I definitely was.
That's amazing.
Doing my drawing first.
Are you still in touch with that teacher?
Yeah, Kathy King has been like a total mentor and an amazing resource for me. And boy, have I let her know what,
yeah,
she was like a watershed person.
Because that was a long time ago. Like this has informed you the rest of your life so far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that gives me goosebumps. That's amazing.
Yeah. It's like one of those teachery moments where you're like, wow, that person. But she just put two and two together and the time was right. And you listened. Yes.
You know.
And I needed a woman to tell me, I think, actually.
Yeah. Well, and you could have, it could have been like that photography guy saying, go back to photo one, and you going, no. Like, she could have said, draw on your ceramics, and you could have said, no, watch this, I'm going to do the opposite. But she was the right person at the right time, and yeah, it's just crazy, like, the rest of all the other stuff we're about to talk about.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, okay, so you graduate, and then what did you do? So you're in Boston.
Yeah, I went from being a farm kid in Vermont, living on a commune. My parents quit the farm and then went and did some farm educating in summer camps in Vermont. And then I moved to Boston, so it was like a real contrast. So I tried the city for a while and graduated. And I moved back to Vermont to work for a woman named Miranda Thomas, who has a pottery still in Vermont, in Bridgewater, Vermont, near where I grew up. I was living in Woodstock, and where I went to high school. So my parents were still there. I moved home And I had received a grant from this museum school to travel, and it was like a no strings attached travel grant. And I knew I wanted to try to save more money to do it. So I was living inexpensively in a like sort of auxiliary apartment in my parents' home. And working for Miranda Thomas, and she's a full-time studio potter who has an amazing business. She was a family friend. Her husband had learned how to make furniture from my uncle, who was a furniture maker. More makers in the family. and she was another like incredibly huge person, because basically I was like, do I want to be a potter or do I want to be an artist? And to me, they were very different things. And I had come from this really specific training to be an artist, and was trained to value fine art over craft. And Miranda Thomas had worked for Michael Cardew, who's like one of the most famous British potters. And he was Bernard Leach's first student or assistant. In England, and so Bernard Leach is sort of the granddaddy of the contemporary studio pottery movement, for those who don't know. And so it was like this incredibly direct lineage for me to come into like a very traditional studio pottery environment and be exposed to a very non-academic and very business and sort of practical oriented, like almost like traditional journeyman, apprentice, master kind of situation. And it just so happened that Michael Cardew's grandson, Ara Cardew, was looking for a green card and was working alongside me, throwing 40 hours a week. And I was hired in this, like, really, it was, like, really kind of amazing that she hired me. Like, I still scratch my head about it sometimes, but she did, and it was incredible. So I was throwing pots full time, and I'd only come to decide to do clay in my last year of school. So my technical skills were, like, not good. Like, I was really not a very good potter. And I learned so much about form and how to integrate form and surface. She did a lot of drawing on her pots, so it was a really good residency, apprenticeship for me that way. And so I worked there for a year and a half, and then I had earned enough money to go travel for 6 months in Europe. And so I traveled in Europe, and I actually, like a month before leaving to go on this trip to Europe, this woman walked into the pottery when I was working for Miranda and said, oh, I just came back from this lovely vacation in the West Indies in the Caribbean. And there's this potter down there, and his name is, you know, Michael. And he needs assistance in the winter to like work on this, on Beckway, which is like near Mustique, which is like the super posh, like, Denzel Washington goes there, you know, it's like crazy. And I was like, can I have their number? And he like lived in France and England part of the year and in the West Indies. And so when I was in France, I like looked this guy up and I was like, hey, I'm a potter. I'd love to come work for you. I mean, I was so unbelievably like, I don't know if it was entitled or just like, my husband calls me a battering ram. Like I just don't give up on things. So I showed up at this guy's house in the Dordogne, which is like it's like a really rural southwestern part of France. And he interviewed me by throwing me on the wheel and being like, make these things. And I just had to like crank out a bunch of stuff. And he was like, you're hired. Do you want to come live in the West Indies for 3 months? And like, I'll pay for your trip and pay for your housing and all your expenses. And I was like, yes.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, so I went from travel throughout Europe and seeing all the museums that I had studied and like doing the classic sort of post-college tour and, you know, hooking up with people in hostels, and it was the most amazing thing. And then I went to the West Indies from London and spent 3 months like working for, and I, Mick Jagger bought some of my work while I was down there. I mean, it was like a totally weird, like
This sounds like you're telling me like the weirdest dream you had. It's like, okay, listen to this dream I had last night. So I'm in France, right?
Yeah, right. It's true.
Old were you? So you were like 23?
I was 23. Like, good, I had just graduated from college like a year before. Yeah, I mean, wow. So I came back with no money in my pocket. And it was...
Who cares?
Yeah, I was like pretty psyched about that. And then the museum school called me not long after that to say that one of the faculty was going on sabbatical and they needed someone to cover their like continuing education classes and tech work. And so I moved back to Boston actually, and worked as a tech and a florist. I walked into a flower shop, like the best flower shop in Boston. It's so pretentious. Like, I want a job here, and they were like, okay.
Oh my gosh.
You know? Crazy. And so
there is something to be said for youthful confidence.
Totally brazen. I mean, it was like I was fully prepared for them to be like, no.
I was just gonna say, did you ever expect anybody to say no?
Absolutely. Like I was going about it in a pretty humble way, actually, I think, despite how it might seem from this end of things. I really wanted to learn. I mean, I was really interested in, I was making vases. I wanted to learn about how people were using them. And I love flowers. My mother's, in addition to me, she's an incredible gardener. And that was like a real passion for her. And growing food was part of the farm. I mean, they had a CSA. And so I knew a lot about it. And it was sort of natural. And John Paul, the man who owned the floral shop, was just wonderful. And I learned a lot about color, actually,
Wow. Did you ever, yeah. I did an interview with Rebecca Louise Law. She does these amazing flower installations just with like tens of thousands of flowers. Yeah. And she said that she went and like got jobs at flower shops so that she could totally understand her medium, basically. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, that's so funny. So sort of same thing in a way for a different purpose.
Yeah, I mean, I needed the work, but it was also really...
Yeah, same for her. She needed the work, yeah.
Yeah. And that led to a residency, and I started applying for a lot of juried exhibitions, and I got a couple galleries to sell the pots that I was making, and I got to spend the time and energy there back in the school environment with the resources of the school to use... to make work, which was really amazing and a total gift. And they totally knew that they were hooking me up. I mean, it was like amazing.
I think that's why so many people work in universities and stuff too, because you have access to information and people and studio space and all of that. So live it up.
Yeah, it was an awesome experience. And the residency, while I was living in Boston during that time, I met my husband. I was living in a commune on Beacon Hill, with 20 residents, a Quaker community, intentional community. And he like rolled up and was doing like a conservation project on the building that I was living in, and like literally knocked on the door one day. And, it was kind of amazing. And he's a builder, he's a woodworker and a, preservation carpenter and timber framer. So we have this like wood clay thing going.
Wow.
And I started applying for graduate schools a couple of years later, and or a year or so later after he had finished his undergraduate degree, he went back to school. And I got into school at the University of Colorado for graduate school, and that was my first choice. I was really lucky, I think. Again, sort of, I received a rejection letter and an acceptance letter in the same year. I was, like, pretty low on the wait list, and I think a bunch of people rejected their offers, and I got this, like, call in May, like, are you still interested? And I was like, yes.
Oh my gosh.
So I went, and it was an incredible experience. It was a 3-year program in ceramics. And Betty Woodman, who's one of the sort of premier ceramic artists, female ceramic artists in the country, she's in her 80s, she's amazing, had started the program there. And her work is a lot to do with making objects into paintings and paintings into objects. And I was really interested in how she had formed the program there, and hopeful that she would throw in a critique here and there if she were back in town. And she definitely did. And it was amazing.
Oh, so many cool women in your life, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. that just sort of showed up right when they were supposed to, or you showed up right when you were supposed to, or something.
Yeah, I'm definitely an opportunist. And I'm definitely an optimist, and I think a risk taker. I mean, my parents ran a farm for a really long time, and I think that watching them work so hard, it was sort of like, if you just work really hard at it, hopefully it'll pay off, right? Like,
yeah.
just show up. And I think, you know, I think I show up and I hit deadlines and I work really hard to collaborate with people, not mm-hmm. just make work and give it to them. I collaborate, and I really think that's a huge part of what's been successful for me in my work. That sort of treating it as a partnership and not just me knowing everything about what's good here.
Right. Well, I know I wanted to ask you about all of you have done so many collaborations recently, but we're going to get to that. Okay. Yeah. So you finished grad school, you're in Colorado, then where are you going?
Yeah. So 3 years of graduate school and I was like, I'm going to go be a professor, except that it was 2008 when I graduated. There were literally two jobs for ceramic artists in the country that year. And I was like, probably not going to get one of those, but I still threw my hat in the ring, you know, like what the hell?
Yeah. You know, Mick Jagger might hire you. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. I wish I'd actually met him, but he apparently really likes blue.
So oh, actually, there you go.
On a side note, had like designed flowers for his suite at the Four Seasons when I was a floral designer in Boston as well. And they got sent back because in his rider, his contract, it had to be blue flowers with no scent. And I had sent like a hyacinth for his bathroom and like scented and they got returned. And I was like, oh, he must really have a thing for blue because the pots he bought for me were blue. Anyway, just so if anyone ever wants to get Mick Jagger's attention, just make it blue.
There you go.
Entertain.
That's the inside scoop in this podcast.
I'm pretty sure I'm never going to come across him again in my career. But
I don't know. That's twice now.
I still make a lot of blue things.
There you go. Third time lucky. Who knows?
And so my husband, and he was working as a timber framer out there for one of the best timber frame operations in the country. Actually, it was really kind of amazing how that all, I mean, we definitely intentionally chose places to go to graduate school that he was like, yes, I think we're both avid backcountry skiers and telemark skiers. So we were pretty excited about that, except that he went and I went to graduate school. So I would like kind of watch him skiing.
You're
right.
Like,
oh, I want to go skiing. But we moved back east. Actually, my parents have a big property in Vermont, and they built their own off-the-grid cabin there, and they were offering us some acreage to build our own place. They really wanted us to live nearby them, and we moved back with this sort of, like, idealistic notion of living off the grid in Vermont, you know, like, we all kind of think that would be amazing, and then we got there, and we were like, oh, hell no, like, this is not us anymore. I was like, I need a cute cafe, and
yeah.
I can't. I was like, no, I think I spent too much time in Boulder.
Like, yeah, no kidding.
I gotta find the equivalent. So we had been living, when my husband was finishing up his undergraduate degree, we had been living in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is where we live now. So we moved there, an hour south of my parents. And
that's a pretty good compromise.
It was. And Oliver had work connections there, and it was 2009, and suddenly I was pregnant as well, and like, trying to make a living as a studio potter. And when I was in graduate school my last semester, Beth Lippman, who's a really wonderful glass artist who you should think about talking to.
I think I know that name.
Really incredible, incredibly generous, and super smart woman. She was running the residency program at the Kohler Factory, which is the toilet and sink company, but they have this amazing residency program where you can come, all expenses paid, you get a stipend, you get housing, you get travel expenses, and basically a key to the factory to work for 3 months using their facilities and making work. And
wow.
She came as a visiting artist and was like, you have to apply. And I was like, I really thought it was for more established artists. But I was like, all right, I'll, you know, whatever, I'll see what. And so I got it, and I just found out I was pregnant. And so I had to, like, my husband and I were in the process of leaving Vermont. And so he left and came down to Northampton to set us up while I was in Wisconsin at this factory for 3 months in the middle of the winter, my sort of end of my first trimester, beginning of my.
Were you sick?
I was pretty, yeah, it was an interesting drive to Wisconsin, shall we say. It was a lot of small people involved.
Oh, God.
And then it was amazing because we were on welfare. Like, we had free health care in the state of Vermont because we were earning so little. My husband couldn't find work when we were in Vermont. That was part of the problem. I was working at Dartmouth College teaching. They have a non-academic studio there, and so I was teaching there a few days a week. And then I was an early adopter of Etsy. I had started when I was graduate school in 2006. Or 2007, I started selling on Etsy.
Wow.
And I was making good money. Like I was earning enough to like have a studio and like kind of pay our bills, except that we were living at my parents' house.
Yeah.
My husband wasn't working, so it was like, this isn't, and I'm pregnant now, so you've got to get a job. So we moved where we could, and I came back after, like, I was paid for, because I was at this residency where they paid for everything, and I got to make this amazing body of work, and Leslie Umberger, there's an art center that's run by, so there's Herb Kohler, who runs the Kohler Factory, and then his sister Ruth is a philanthropist and runs this amazing art center that has an incredible collection with a large focus on folk art, but they also do other exhibitions. And they were curating a show about American artists. And they came in and needed some work that was going to work in a light-filled space. And ceramics doesn't fade, so it was good for that. And they basically came in and kept visiting the studio. And finally they said, we'd love a piece for the show. And then they were like, we want everything that you're going to make in this residency
for the show.
Suddenly went from like a nice residency exploring things to like, oh my God, I have to
produce.
And it was like my first museum show opportunity. And I made an amazing amount of work and I was really productive and it was kind of shocking. But the men in the factory were really worried about me. They like kept coming over and being like, don't lift that and don't do that.
Oh.
really concerned. But it was like an incredible way to start off my career. After I had a solo show right after my undergrad, my thesis show in Boulder, a Denver gallery had seen the work and really wanted to show, and I had sort of stupidly made my thesis show for sale and sold everything, and I was pretty green, so I didn't, and they were like, yes, we'd like, you know, the show was, thesis was in April, end of April, early May, and the show at this new gallery was in June, and it was a solo show. The entire gallery was like 500 square feet or something, and I had no work. I had to make like a whole, it was like, oh, just kidding, like you get to do your thesis like all over again.
Oh, and, like, in 2 months, yeah.
6 weeks to make like a whole huge, but it, what was really incredible about it was that I was forced to respond to the feedback I got from my defense. And it's this amazing thing where, and when you're in fine arts, it's your terminal degree. And so for 3 years, I worked towards a show and writing a 12-page thesis about it. And so it's almost like doing a doctorate because you have to not only do the research and the homework and write about it, but you also have to produce the work.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was this amazing opportunity to not lose the momentum of, like, most people like collapse at the end of their thesis and they're like, I'm done, dying, I'm going to work in a bookstore for a year, I can't handle this. And I just had to keep going, and I honestly think that the pace has never let up. Like, it just never, like, I took a quick break after having my daughter, but it just never let up.
Well, and you put yourself in spots for opportunities too, you know, it's so impressive and inspiring.
Well, and they happened. I mean, this was the thing. It's like,
yeah.
You throw yourself at a wall, but if it doesn't stick, you know, like it was like amazing how many of these things came back to me. Like it was like I was listening when those opportunities came knocking, the right ones. But yeah, so we moved to Northampton and I had my daughter here after coming back from the residency in Wisconsin, and I had a museum show offered to me at the Bennington Art Museum in Bennington, Vermont, like 2 months after my daughter was born. So I had to quickly start working on a body of work for that. And it was really amazing because my mom could see, like, she came down once a week and gave me a day or like a day and a half in the studio because she would spend the night. And my studio was in the basement of we had a rental apartment. And the woman who owned the apartment was like a miracle. Like, she let me have a studio in her basement. Although the basement flooded so much that we had to, like, I was literally in wellies, like, every time I worked in the bin, everything was in like Rubbermaid containers.
Oh my gosh.
It was wet at the time. But it forced me to get back to work like before I was really ready. But at the same time, it forced me to get back to work and again, like, pick up the momentum and sort of figure out, like, how do you work, like it was suddenly having to work as a mom meant like not just finishing what you had started. You had to like put it away and be able to come back to it like at the drop of a hat if she woke up from a nap. Or
right.
So I kind of had to figure out how to cope with that. And it worked. I mean, I figured it out and figured out that I had to go back to work at night after she went to bed at 8 o'clock. Like there was no like sit down with a glass of wine and watch a TV show. It was
yeah.
like you back to work. We were living off of my husband's income at the time, which was, you know, like $1,500 a month or something. And we were on welfare. And I mean, it was like a come hell or high water. I was going to make this work kind of thing. And I actually remember my daughter was about a year old. Not quite a year. We didn't have enough money for childcare, and I was like trying to figure it out. And I had hired someone to come a couple mornings a week, and we didn't really have the money. It was like a direct trade. It was like I was selling pots to pay for the privilege of making pots.
Right.
And
yeah.
I made like $1,000 that year, and I was like, this is so. I was literally selling my cups for like $110. I was making everything I was selling everything I made. I was working my ass off, and I was like, you know what? This is nuts. Like, how am I gonna, like, I can't, I'm not even selling on Etsy, like direct sales to people and getting some good wholesale accounts out of it. It was like this really bizarre realization that even though I'm working as hard as I can, there's not enough, like it's not valued enough to make it worthwhile. And literally, like, as I was paying taxes, pretty much, like, this email came in my inbox from Anthropology. Like, it was April of 2010. My daughter was born in August of 2009. She wasn't quite a, and I had a solo show at the Clay Studio in Philadelphia in a couple of months. And they emailed me and were like, we'd love to work with you on something. Would you be interested? And they had seen my work in a gallery in New York. There's a small pottery in the village. There's a place called Greenwich House Pottery, which is like a place where you take classes, and they also have like a gallery space and shop at that time on Jones Street and right off of Bleecker. And one of the executives had like walked by and was like, "Those are so cute. We should work with her."
Oh, and Mick Jagger when she walked
yeah,
by?
I wouldn't put it past Patty. She was the person who found my work. She's amazing. Her husband works for the Tory Burch Foundation. So yeah, I wouldn't, you know, like maybe.
Yeah.
Kate Winslet bought some of my work out of that gallery at one point.
Wow. Oh my God.
Yeah. Kind of cool to think of her drinking out of one of my
tapes. Yeah.
But that was sort of at the moment where I was realizing that I was struggling, and I was offered a teaching job not long after that, teaching at a local community college, which I took. But Anthropology came back to me, and they were really interested. And I said, "Look, I think the only way that this could work is if I design." I had seen what they had done with Natalie Latte, who's another designer who had been working with them for a long time. And I said, "You know, they wanted to buy pots for me to resell, like to vend to them at wholesale." And I just said, "Look, it's unrealistic for me to do that, and the price point would be so ridiculous that I don't think you would go for it. And let me design something for you." I had no idea how to do that, but I, you know, what's the process? And they said, "Okay, sure, and we'll just pay you a design fee." And I didn't know what was fair or what wasn't fair, or, you know, I mean, I had no idea what I was doing. And there's like a very old, long, boring conversation within the ceramics community, or at least it was still going on at that time, about handmade versus industry. And this is sort of the peak of the DIY. Like,
right, yeah.
Everyone was sort of cottage industry, everything, because everyone had been fired from their corporate jobs in 2009. And I was grappling sort of internally with my education and what, like, having this be perceived as a sellout. I was working with galleries, like really important galleries in the ceramic community. I was championing the handmade. This was like kind of my shtick. And I was selling on Etsy, and it was like all, I was part of that community. And here I am like grappling with the reality of it financially with a kid and being on welfare with 2 degrees and like wondering how that happened. And when they offered me money for the first collection, which was like it was a ton of work, but it was like $17,000. And I was like, I haven't earned that much money in a year.
Oh Oh my God.
As a potter, it was like life changing. It was like winning a grant, basically. Yeah. And I was like, even if this is something I do with them once, it means that I can buy the kiln that I need. It means I can get a new computer that's like going to replace this one that's about to die tomorrow. Like, it was so unbelievably needed. And I went for it and I lost some galleries, and there was a lot of articles written in trade magazines about it, like interviews with me. People were really like,
oh, I was going to ask. So people actually had a loud opinion about it.
Yes. There was camps. Like, there was like, what would Molly Hatch, you know, like, are you for Molly Hatch or against Molly Hatch?
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was really intense. And I even had gone to like a, you know, and that was my perception from where I was standing too. I mean, I don't know that it was really like that big of a focus of people's everyday conversation, but it was definitely being talked about. And even at a utilitarian clay conference where I was invited to be a presenter in 2013, like 3 years later, I was still working with anthropology, and I still am now, but I went and I was like, when they invited me, I was like, are you sure you want me to come? Like, this is about functional ceramics and it's sort of championing the studio potter and it's going to be conversation. And I'm like, I'm showing in really high-end galleries in New York and my handmade things are selling to museums and that's fine. And I feel like I'm justified in coming to this conference, but there's going to be a lot of questions and concern and sort of, it's, I don't want to have the whole conference be concerning whether or not to work with industry or,
right.
And it, they were like, no, this is a relevant conversation. It needs to happen. And it was, there were points in that conference where people were coming up to me and being like, I'm on your side. And I'd be like, what conversations are you having? Like, what? Like, people would be like really intense about it, like really intense about asking questions. And basically what it came down to for me was like, I wouldn't have gone forth with the collaboration of the anthropology if I didn't feel like the integrity of my idea. Like, what happened was I took them some work. They asked me for a tableware collection, 5 mugs and like a place setting, which is like, you know, dinner plate, salad plate, bowl. And, I brought it to them. I brought them physical, you know, one-to-one scale prototypes, like what I would make in the studio. And then they weren't sure that they were going to be able to replicate my process, which is sort of an inlay, sort of textural process in the clay, and then hand-painted color on top of that.
Mm.
So they were like, why don't you do some of this as flat artwork, and we'll scan it and use it as decals. And I knew that's how they had worked with Natalie Latte, and the quality of the decals were amazing. And I was like, okay. And I took a long time to figure out how to get the same mark making on paper as I, because I had been drawing on pots for so long, I had sort of forgotten about drawing on paper.
Hmm.
And so I had to kind of re-teach myself how to do it. So I came in with this whole collection in sort of August. And then in October, they invited me back to their home offices in Philadelphia. And I went and I sat down with the buyers and they were like, here are the first samples. They did it. And I was, and it was like what I was sort of justifying in my mind that it was a completely different process with decal. And that was like a more commercial process. And of course they couldn't replicate my handmade things because of what I had been taught. And they like, of course they could, it's China. Like, that's what they're good at. They're good at copying stuff. That's like what, it's like a cultural, it's like a cultural point of pride. And so I'm like looking at a replica of my pot that's like basically better than my pot. And I was like, oh my God, they totally did it. And it was this amazing moment where I realized I had to decide right then, like, these can't compete with the things that I'm making in my studio. I have to make something else.
Huh. Yeah.
And or I have to just nix the whole project and be like, sorry, I can't do this. It's too close to my work. And I decided to go with it. So explaining that to potters, who, you know, like,
yeah,
you think they can't do this and industry can do this. In fact, there are very few things that industry can't do. And so my query was, like, I had two things that I wanted people to come away with from that was, when they call, when, you know, J. Crew calls or whatever,
yeah,
anthropology calls you, you can already have a sense of what you would do or how you would approach that or say no or say yes or yes but or whatever, because I've had this experience to, it's going to happen more and more. It's a trend in industry. Like, they're seeing this as an untapped resource, and as they should.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really good ideas here that everyone should be able to have access to. And And you can decide for yourself, but I'm putting this out there for you to have that moment of thinking about it now, like before it happens.
Why wait until that moment to think it through?
Right.
Yeah.
And then you can also, like, I also wanted people to think about what industry can't do. So like what makes a pot not, like, I thought my pots weren't replicatable in my industry. And so it was starting to become really obvious, like, well, if you're going to bother making it by hand, make it so, make it too expensive or too hard of a process to, you know, like, it's like wood fire potters have it in the bag, right? Like, every pot is coming out of that kiln different. Like, you could never replicate a pot. Like, you could never do it. You could replicate a look, but you couldn't replicate that pot. And that's like, you know, like, home court advantage big time. Like, go be a wood fire potter if you want to just, like, not even worry about it. Like, they've got it solid. But, you know, it was an interesting thing to talk about, like, what's more important, you know, is it the integrity? So, like, for me, I was making these pots that were mugs with a picture of an 18th century teacup on it because I don't drink tea out of a teacup, but I drink out of a mug, but I love the look of a teacup. So I was like, how do I merge, like, my love of those two things in one thing and have it be a drawing of a teacup and a teacup, at a mug at the same time? Sort of taking this, like, you know, what I do conceptually in my one-of-a-kind work that's sold, you know, very expensive plate installations, how do I translate that to an everyday object? And sort of, I really try to do that across all platforms that I work in, is have this sort of same, it's just a different permeation of a same question that I'm asking, or it's a different answer to the same question that I'm asking.
That's so smart.
So I was saying, you know, for me, the integrity of this was to make a pot into a drawing and represent that. And this was the first set of mugs that I made for Anthropology. And the integrity of the idea, the concept of the work, the functionality of it, it's all there. And you can have it for $16 from Anthropology, or you can have it for $120 from me, you know? And it was like, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Seems like a no-brainer to me.
when did you start doing your big plate installations? Was it around that time?
Or had you already been doing that? I was doing that at that time. And okay. So what happened was, Anthropology and my fine art work kind of took off at the same, like, my work with Anthropology that's continued. I mean, it's now 2017. It's been 7 years of working with them. And like 500 projects later, I mean, it's like really crazy. It's been an amazing run. So I had a solo show in Philadelphia 2 months after Anthropology had called me, and they first saw my work in person at that solo show in Philadelphia at the Clay Studio there. And at the same time, Leslie Farron, who's one of the sort of foremost ceramic gallery owners in the U.S., is local to me here in Northampton. She was keeping an eye on what I was doing. She had seen my work and some of the installations that I had done for my thesis show. She saw that I had been to Kohler. And a couple of her artists had said, you know, you should check this girl out. She's kind of having a moment. And this was before anything had happened with Anthropology. So I had the show at the Clay Studio, and she was like, this is great. I want to take it to a couple art fairs. And I started developing this work for her that was at a much higher price point. I mean, starting around $2,000 for a wall installation then, which is now gone. I mean, I've sold work for over $100,000 at this point, which is kind of insane to think about.
Oh, my gosh.
She went from sort of taking my work to a couple of fairs, selling it out, kind of going, we are onto something, and, like, pushing it. I'm going to Miami every year to show it during Basel at Art Miami and selling out there a couple years in a row. And then she started to get a little anxious about how much time I was spending. I was spending about half my time working on projects for her. And at that time, they were more costly to make than, like, I wasn't making money off of them. They were, even though they were expensive, it was the amount of time and energy and effort that went into making them was huge. So I had to basically buy myself the time through the design work to fund the time in the studio for the one-of-a-kind work, which is now flip-flopped, actually, pretty seriously. But she she and I parted ways over that, and I found a new gallery in New York, who Todd Merrill Studio, who is a design and decorative arts gallery in Tribeca. And he and I have been working together now longer than I had worked with Leslie. We're going into our fourth year, and he's just been amazing. Like, he really gets the work, and he has the right clientele and a really incredible staff, and it's been incredible to watch them. So I've done museum installations permanently for the High Museum in Atlanta. They have a lobby piece of mine that's over 500 plates in their lobby there next to their coat room, which is I took a reflected two 18th century plates they have in their permanent collection that were kind of easily overlooked, and wanted to highlight the collection, their permanent collection, with a new contemporary piece, and that was the goal of their goal as well. And so I made this mural-sized wall of plates for them, and I'm working on a similar piece now that's even bigger, actually, for the Newark Museum in New Jersey, that'll go up in August of this year, and lots of private commissions. And
how many plates are in that one? In the one coming up?
Three niches that have 190 plates in each, so it's like just over, well, just almost the same. Yeah, so it's like just around 600 plates.
Oh
just.
My God, they're incredible. Because it's so funny, because I knew of your work because of the anthropology and Land of Nod, and you know, all of your collaborations and your teacup book. I knew about all of that. But then I don't know, this is really terrible of me, but that I didn't, and then I knew about the installation work, but for some reason I didn't piece together that it was the same person.
Yeah, I mean, I've kept it really separate.
Yeah. But your name is so like memorable. I don't know why, but so anyway, I was, you know, obsessing over the installation pieces, which is what I was going to write my big post about. And
oh, wow.
By that point I had pieced together who, you know, that it was the same person, but, because they are very, like, you can tell it is the same person, but to have such, to have this fine art practice, mm-hmm. and to have this design practice, and very commercial and very, you know, you're kind of, can I say, living the dream? Like, that's what it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, it's really schizophrenic sometimes. Like, it feels a little nuts sometimes.
Well, and you're a mom, so throw that in there too.
Yeah. I have an amazing husband who's really, like, makes it possible in a lot of ways, but I think I wonder how, like, I keep saying to myself, like, is one going to require more of me at some point than I can handle? And I have staff. I have two assistants who work for me and help paint and help in the studio with the one-of-a-kind work,
mm-hmm.
And the online shop as well, and I think that I've been able to figure out ways to grow to meet the demand there at the same time. And now with the design end of things, that's really just me doing that. And I don't know, I'm curious. Like, I feel like I'm going to continue. I see merits in doing both, and they feed me in really different ways.
Yeah.
And I find that I get into these really long, I mean, I've been working on this installation for Newark, like, since last August. It's been, like, an insane project.
I can't even imagine the planning. Like, when you look at them,
right?
You know, I'm just like, because I'm an artist too, you know, and I look at them and I think, whoa. Like, the planning that must go into the shapes and the designs that are going to be on each one is from a big scale, like, looking at the whole thing, to the minutia of, like, working on one plate.
Yep.
Knowing how that's going to fit into everything. Like, that's,
yeah.
That's a lot of, like, that's a different way of using your brain than designing, you know, like the anthro stuff.
Right. Right. And I think, you know, I think the fact that I'm thinking and studying and doing my homework and research for these larger scale projects that require a long-term investment, I want to it's like the same thing I was saying before. I like kind of want to answer the same questions that I'm thinking about there in a different permutation in design.
Yeah.
And so the objects that I'm designing for, you know, industry to manufacture are definitely me, like, trying on different versions of that, or like maybe it's like a little more tongue-in-cheek. There's a sense of humor or play there that I don't get to execute when it's like someone spending like really a lot of money on something. It's like really, there's not room for that in the same way for me. Like it's just a different part of me that
it is kind of nice to like, to not get burnt out. I mean, do you get burnt out? Because it's kind of cool to have, to be able to flip back and forth so that you're not just doing one thing all the time.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely like an interesting organization of time, and sometimes deadlines converge and it's tough. And I know, I mean, the nice thing is that because the work takes so long to make in my studio practice with my gallery in New York, I usually have 2 or 3 months ahead to plan the work and make the work and execute it before the art fair. And I can figure out how to manage my time and project manage the bigger projects like this installation for Newark on top of that. And then the deadlines for the illustration work and surface design and product design that I do, they're so quick. Like, it's like really fast turnarounds usually, in my opinion. I mean, I'm sure I ask for more time sometimes than they would like to give me. it's like, do I have time to fit that in? And it's like, I can say yes or no to those in a really, and I actually don't say no very often. The companies that I choose not to work with are often companies that I wouldn't buy their product, or it's not like it's like pretty cut and dry for me to say no. And I definitely have sort of parameters that, I want to work within for what I, design. And I think it's exciting when I get to make a ceramic object for a manufacturer, like some of the products that I've just recently launched with Land of Nod to Piggy Banks and some wall art.
Yeah.
Really nice to be able to make something new, and they appreciate so much that I can hand them a prototype of something.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, it's also now 7 years later where, you're not just making it up going, yeah, I totally know how to do that. You know, it's like, you actually do know how to do it. So, you can turn it around a lot faster than you could 7 years ago when you were trying to figure it out.
That's true. And then I find that in the design end of things, like I've had to teach myself a lot of, like I didn't, I mean, I was not trained as an illustrator. My use of Photoshop is probably very strange and bizarre to most people.
you've got your special ways. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I really don't have training as a product designer or surface designer. And, I have training as to do drawings, and I think I have my formal training as an artist for sure. I've definitely got 2 degrees in fine art, but really what I've come at, I wonder sometimes, because it's such a hard field to break into, and I know that there are a lot of people that would kill to have the career that I have achieved, and I sometimes am like, I didn't ask for it. It just kind of, like, I followed. I also didn't let it go. I mean, it could
have been. I was going to say, you fought. You were in a flooded basement in Wellies. Like, so it's not like you didn't sit on the couch and have a glass of wine.
I took every opportunity to go to Anthropology and be like, oh, like I was like a Rolex salesman on the street. Like I was like, you need artwork? I got artwork. Like, look at all these things that I can do. I mean, I went down with boxes and boxes of stuff every time I met with them, and they would be like, oh my God, they didn't know. I mean, they were in Kids and Candy Store. They were really excited about it, and obviously it worked out for me.
But that's why when people say, what's the secret? This drives me crazy because I have a few people in my life that will say, oh, you've got a horseshoe up your ass. And it's just like, no, I'm exhausted. Like, I work really, really hard. I'm not lucky. And I've said this before, people listen all the time will have heard this. My dad used to always say, when I'd say, oh, I'm so lucky, he'd say, oh, yeah, it's a funny thing. The harder you work, the luckier you get.
Yeah.
And, it's so true. So when people say, like, oh, how do you have this career? It's like, well, flooded basement, welfare, and you're still... Right. working, and you're still hustling, and like that's how, and you're super talented, but it's like that hustle and the not giving up thing that is so inspiring. And your story is just, I knew all the end product stuff about you, but hearing your origin story is so inspiring and exciting, and it makes me want to stay up till 3 in the morning working on stuff.
Yeah, I think with with interest, you can kind of make, I mean, I was at the School of Anthropology, I like to say, for, you know, like, it took me a really long time to figure stuff out. And I spent like all this time and I was getting paid to do this work, but it was like, you know, yeah, I learned how to be a designer through working with them.
Yeah. And, you know, any way you learn is a good way. Like, you know, there's a lot of, you know, self-taught is a four-letter word kind of thing. And it's just like, why? Like, the fact that you were able to teach yourself something, like, that's pretty awesome. Why is being self-taught bad? Like, that you have the discipline and the interest and the curiosity to figure it out, like, that should get you a gold star too.
Well, yeah, I think it was just, like, I could recognize that I had something that was different than what they were seeing. And I had, it took some time to figure out what exactly that was.
Yeah.
And it, cause they weren't really telling me that. It was just like, what is it that, why does it, and it's because I can offer form as well as surface.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really my strength. And figuring that out was, it took a long time. And so I think that it kind of just goes back to what a lot of people say. It's like, whatever makes you, you or you as an individual, you know, different than others, it's like, exploit that as far as you possibly can and enjoy it, revel in it. I mean, it's the thing that's going to pay off in the end.
Yeah, it sets you apart from everything because there's only one you. I know, I love that. When I started my blog, that was the same thing. You know, I thought, oh, there's so many art blogs out there. What's, you know, what's the difference? And my husband said, you know, you.
Right.
Your voice and your taste, like nobody else is going to have an art blog like you because it's just you, as long as you're true to who you are, you know, and it's the same with art. It's the same with everything, really. You just have to own your thing.
Yep.
I have one question before we go into the not so speedy speed round.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Well, this is a long one.
I know, but I love it. It's so good and such a good story. But So did you study art history? Because all your work now, like your installation pieces, your fine art pieces, are very steeped in a lot of art history stuff.
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the things that's really a huge part of a fine art degree, especially at the master's level, or at least as a school at the University of Colorado, was, I mean, the museum school as well, I mean, Tufts University, all of my art history classes were there, and or taught by Tufts professors, and I, theory and art history and sort of really in investing in studying that has become a really big part of understanding my own place in the sort of continuum of ceramic art history in particular, and I think that's where it was sort of like, if, you know, like, how do I differentiate myself from what's already been done? Ceramics, like, there's only so many mugs you can make, I guess. Or, you know, like, I was kind of like, how, like, where do I fit in? And I just started to recognize in graduate school an obsession with the 18th century, which is sort of the peak of decorative art history, the money spent on decorative arts at that time, the peak of the at that time in the mid 18th century, porcelain was worth more than gold. It was a really rare material in the West. It was all of it was export from the East. And I think that my interest in that sort of high low, because now it's a low material. It's a very interesting history. And I think I really liked that dichotomy because of like my family history has a sort of massive dichotomy like that as well. And I grew up like all handmade clothing. We had no money for anything. But I had this grandmother who didn't have to work and she painted portraits of, and it was just like this really fascinating, access to privilege, access to education, access to a lot of the codified behavior that comes with being privileged and expectations from family that go with that, but not the money to back it up. And I think that in my work, I'm constantly exploring that same, like all of the plate installations are earthenware. Most of them are Chinese blank plates that are not handmade. They're imported from China. And I'm playing with this high-low thing there. And then a lot of my production work is like bone china, which is like the finest china you can get. My like fine work that I'm making for consumption and everyday use, I'm using the most expensive materials you can get. It's an interesting, like I'm playing with it a lot. Like, and it's rare. I don't talk about it very much because it's something that a lot of people don't quite it's like hard to contextualize or without a lot of history behind
it. Yeah. I get it. I love that.
Yeah. And I think, like I said before, I think if I hadn't been an artist, I would have been a curator, an art historian. I think my interest in, I mean, I consume art history books. You know, I do my homework for every piece. I'm figuring out, you know, working with museums and institutions to go into their archives and physically look at the objects and talk with the curators about them. And
I know, and when I read that, I was like so jealous, because same thing. I minored in art history. I had friends who would, you know, read their art history books if they had insomnia so they could fall asleep. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I was on the edge of my seat. I loved it. And when I read that about your work, I was just thinking, oh my gosh, I can't even imagine getting to go back there. And
going into the archives of museums is like one of the best. And they're such a mess. Like, they're not pretty.
Yeah,
they're
like
piles of stuff. And you're like, this seems awfully casual. Like, I don't know. Like, can I get
where
some
are your gloves? Yeah, where are they? That's amazing. Yeah, I wanted to know about that, because that was one of the first things when I was, you know, looking at all of your fine art practice work. I was just like, oh, okay, what's her deal with art history? And, you know, I think there's something, you were sort of saying it at the beginning, like you can't know where you're going if you don't know what's come before you. I think it's so important to know that stuff, because how are you supposed to know where you fit?
I'm definitely playing. I mean, some people would describe my work as derivative, probably, and it's definitely like me taking historic motifs or playing with the history of how of export porcelain and interpretation of that through time. And I'm actually working on a book about that right now with a UK publisher that'll be out in December of 2017. That's about the history of objects and their move from the East to the West, but from like a very from my perspective and a sort of more public interest perspective.
Wow.
But yeah, and so I'm getting to write a book about that too, which is really exciting, and illustrate it.
I was going to say, are you illustrating it too?
Yes.
Yay.
And I got to work with some really amazing museums to make that happen too. And I think that it's like when you know and you dig deeper and you start to understand, like it's like playing, I like playing telephone with pattern. It's really like when I start to think about how the objects that I'm playing with artistically and the motifs on them and the patterns on them were exported to Europe and then the Europeans copied them and then I'm playing with that copy and then it gets sent back to China to be remade as a export thing again. It's like this really funny thing that's happening, and it's like a very particular conversation that I don't think a lot of people, like I said, don't talk about very often because it's a little complex, but and you kind of have to know the history of it, but it the irony of it is really, really fun. And I think a lot of my work has to do with that sort of, that
loop.
Play.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Oh my gosh. I could talk to you forever, but I won't, because we both have children and it's dinner time. And, okay. So I have to do my not so speedy speed round. Ready? Okay. Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
See, I wonder, because of all the teacups.
So I know.
There's actually coffee going in the mug that has a picture of a teacup on it.
Coffee until noon, tea afternoon.
Okay. So that you can sleep if you get a chance to sleep?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like that. But it's still like Earl Grey. It's not like tea.
Okay. Unicorn or jackalope?
Oh, unicorn.
I saw the new jackalope mug. I thought
Yeah, the jackalope was a request.
Oh, was it? Okay. So it's all about
the unicorn. Was self.
Yeah. I was a big unicorn gal growing up in, you know, the 80s.
Yeah,
when I wasn't making my pickled bums, I was actually, my son and I, he's 10, we and it's spring break here right now. So in his stocking this year at Christmas, he got this eraser making kit. And it looks like clay, but then you can sculpt it into whatever you want. And then you bake it in the oven for half an hour and it turns into an eraser.
Really cool.
It's so awesome. So
I would have killed for that.
Me too. And so I made a unicorn eraser yesterday.
That's so cool.
I know, 43 years old, and I've got a pink eraser unicorn with a rainbow mane. Anyway.
There's potential product design there.
Tell Anthropology if they're interested. They can call me. okay. You may have answered this. If you could go back in time, when would you go to? 18th century?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Like, if I could go back in time as like an aristocrat.
Yeah, like, a male, a male aristocrat.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe female. They seem to have a lot of fun in the movies.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, but you'd have to have the money and the status in order to really live it up.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I'd be stoked about wearing a corset, but I think I, like, physically, like, Rubenesque, I'm very Rubenesque. I think I might be okay in the, like, yeah, Botticelli era, maybe. Like, that might be another, like, close second.
That sounds good, when we could just be our voluptuous selves if we needed to be.
That's me.
Yeah, me too. Okay, and then the last one, if you could go anywhere in the world right now, where would you go?
We just were talking about this. My husband and I were like, oh, we need to go somewhere. And we were talking about going to Paris because he's never been. And I've been so many times, and his family's English, and he always went to England to see his dad, and he never made it to continental Europe. And we were going to go, and I thought I had enough miles, and we looked, and it was like, no, it was like not. It went from being like, oh, we could go for $1,000 as a family over spring break. And then it was like, no, it was like $3,000.
Well, you'll just wait for some amazing gallery to offer you something where they fly you all over and have you install some crazy thing and pay for it all.
There is a residency at the Sev factory in Paris.
Okay.
Just saying.
You just saying. I'm just talking. You know, I totally use this podcast to just like put stuff out there. Anybody?
I'm a firm believer of talking things into existence.
Oh, me too.
You can manifest things. You got to be careful, though, what you manifest. But you can manifest things. And sometimes you manifest things you don't even know you want, but you make them happen.
Yeah, I know. I have, how old was I when I did it? Oh, Charlie was a baby. Well, he was maybe two. So about 8 years ago, I guess. No, longer than that, because Gels Curator's been around for 8 years. So it was before the blog even existed. On New Year's Day, one year, my husband and I wrote out our 100 list, the 100 things that we'd want or whatever. And then I just tucked it away, and it didn't even, you know, it was just like a New Year's Day thing to do. And a couple of years later, I looked at it, and I had done like 50 of the things.
No way.
Without even realizing, because I think I put them out there. One of them, though, was hug a baby orangutan, and I have not done that.
That sounds doable, though.
I know, right? At some point, that opportunity will present itself, and I will be all in.
Yeah, I think that sounds doable.
Not yet, though. Anyway, that's all the stuff. That was amazing.
Thank you. I mean, it was really fun to talk about. I hope it came across cohesively for everybody.
I understood. I'm sure. I mean, it's such a cool story, and I love that Mick was in there a couple of times. And
it's Kate Winslet. I've got a really star-studded cast here. It was like really.
What was that?
Kate Winslet.
Yeah.
Mick Jagger.
Sure. Name drop. Like they're all in there. I love it. No, I think it's. It was such a good story, and I. You know, it changes. I mean, I see your stuff everywhere, and it's just so cool. I'm sure for everybody listening, too, next time they see a unicorn mug or whatever, to know all of this amazing story behind it. And, you know, I feel bad that you were in a flooded basement with a new baby, but I kind of love that you went from there to now these, like, you know, crazy installations and all the success. It's very inspiring and exciting, and I'm so glad that you shared it with us.
Oh, thanks. And to clarify, we're no longer in that basement.
Yes.
We own our own house. You can see it on Apartment Therapy if you want.
Oh, my gosh. There you go. I know. Well, see, you're a big success story. And I think like that's a huge part of why I do this podcast is I love getting those stories out there. I think because of being an art history nerd, I love that I get to ask you guys this stuff now when you're alive. You know, and we get to hear all the stuff that wouldn't be in an art history book. Like, we wouldn't have heard about, you know, the flooded basement and Mick and whatever. And I love that it's out there. And I'm just so honored whenever artists are, you know, hard on sleeve and just tell me stuff. It's awesome.
Good. Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to tell everyone. Oh. And I look forward to hearing more as you keep going. Your podcast is great. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, you're going to be up in a couple of weeks, and okay. I'm going to do a great big post that goes along with all of everything that we talked about so people can come and check it out. And if I need any photos, I will call you.
Yeah. You feel free to use anything off the web too.
Okay.
I'm more than happy to Yeah.
Okay,
thanks.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Molly.
All right. Have a good night.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Whoa, what a story. To go from a flooded basement to selling a piece for $100,000. Oh my word. I just want to thank Molly so much for being so open and honest and sharing her story with us. The good, the bad, the Mick Jagger, all of it. Here's to being an opportunistic optimist and all of the amazing things that that can present when you just say yes. There are 6 more episodes to go in season 1. Man, I like how that sounds, season 1. And I just had a great idea for 15 summer episodes that will take us through to the beginning of season 2 in September. I'll give you all the ins and outs next week, but see, even just the thought of taking a break gave me the headspace to come up with a really cool idea for summer. I am so excited. Okay, I'm going to stop talking now and let you get on with your day. Thank you, as always, to Satya for supporting this episode, and thank you for listening. There will be more Art for Your Ear next weekend. See you then.